The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, so I'm actually going to keep discussion today pretty short because the games that we've got lined up are pretty long.
Oh, what's that?
Two of them I know are really good. One of them was good last year, so we'll see again this year. It's Chinatown and Grassland, typically. So we'll see. Are they all four player games, at least?
On the last side, we're also going to have Puerto Rico, which will be fine. But I just haven't pulled it out yet.
I call Thieves.
Cool. For people, have you played Thieves before?
No.
Good. Okay. So for people who played San Juan last time, I think Puerto Rico is an interesting comparison because San Juan is actually a sequel to Puerto Rico. So you kind of play in reverse order. That was the one where how would you describe it?
Is it related to Race the Galaxy as well?
Yeah. You choose the action.
Race? Okay, so that takes us right into today's
topic.
Okay, so Puerto Rico is kind of what was... Puerto Rico is the... I guess it was actually the first in the series. I certainly do not know of any immediate predecessors or inspirations. And San Juan's kind of the card game version of this. Which is why we introduced it earlier, because you guys were working on card games. Race to the Galaxy is more of a spiritual successor, as described in the reading. But you could also think of it as a clone with a few upgrades, because it wasn't the same people. It wasn't the same people who made
To clarify, the guy who did San Juan and the guy who did Race to the Galaxy were kind of collaborating. So the games are really similar because they influenced each other, but they were not strictly the same project. Hmm.
So you can think of it as multiple people from the same artist community turning out similar games every time.
Nice.
You know. Informed by each other. And when Race came out, it was very much seen as this is Puerto Rico with problems fixed, or gameplay expanded. And problems added too, and you know, and of course a completely different theme. But at least in terms of game mechanics, that's a nice connection that you can actually see among the games that you played before and you're going to be playing today. Not every single game that we've got here is got that kind of heritage. In fact, today's games aren't specifically picked to match up with today's team of sequels. The only reason why I'm talking about sequels is because we have to talk about it sooner or later. Of course, Battlestar Galactica is straight up adaptation of the TV series, and I wouldn't quite call this a sequel in a sense because simply this is not based on a previous Battlestar Galactica game. I'm sure there were previous Battlestar Galactica games that were based on the old 70s TV series that have nothing to do with this one. This is more of an adaptation, and the reason why I'm using that phrase is so that we can be fairly clear in our vocabulary. This is taking elements of something that's in a different medium, like a film, like TV series, and trying to figure out what in that TV series, in that world that has been created, that fictional world, might yield interesting gameplay. And this game is pretty much about figuring out who is the Cylon among all the players. Among all the players, there's going to be traitors. And you try to hide your activities. And you try to help help human race survive if you happen not to be a traitor. But some of the things that you end up doing in order to help the human race not to survive may end up looking suspicious. And if you played Mafia, it kind of has a little bit of that feel. Only this is way more heavyweight in terms of game mechanics because they really, really wanted to make you think like you have the same dilemmas that the characters in the TV show have.
So. Does the Cylon know that he or she is a Cylon?
I believe you can find out halfway.
Okay.
Yeah. If I recall the rules correctly. And then there are players who will know right from the beginning. So there may be more than one. In fact, there generally is more than one. I'm psyched. Okay, so there were a bunch of different things that were listed in Felix Reason as reasons why people want to do sequels. But for the most part, the big one is just you're building off an established base. You're not having to rebuild everything from scratch. In many cases, a sequel doesn't actually cost less or take less time than making the original game. You just end up hopefully spending the development time a little bit more wisely. Like you avoid a lot of pitfalls because you're pretty much making a very similar game. The game industry has been one of those fields where, oddly enough, part two, you know, the follow-up tends to be better than the original, as opposed to you know, how many movie sequels are generally better than the original. Godfather.
That's rare.
Back to the Future. It's
rare.
It's really rare. I'm thinking the Clint Eastwood Man of No Name series, Godfather, any other?
Back to the Future.
Back to the Future. I
don't know. It could go either way.
I don't agree.
It's
arguable.
It's arguable.
The novel is first off.
Yeah. I mean, like Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Empire Strikes Back. I'll get you.
Spider-Man, perhaps?
Spider-Man 2?
I don't know, I felt like they were all bad.
They're all
bad.
That's true. It was better.
But yeah, you know, it's really difficult because... Dark Knight? I will give you that. But, you know, it's still kind of tough. Whereas how many good game sequels... How many games can you think of where you played both the original and then the sequel to it?
Super Smash. Also.
Usually
just the sequel.
Oh, okay. Because okay, for some of them, the space apart so far that you actually only ended up playing.
I mean, like
Half-Life 2, for instance. You know,
Starcraft
2.
Age of Empires
like 1, 2, and then
X.
3.
Shogun Total War. The Total War series.
Yeah, now Total War is kind of an interesting thing because they don't pitch them as sequels, but they very much pitch them as a series. And the whole idea is that if you liked one game, you actually know a lot about what any of the other games in that series do. Sure, graphically they are upgrading, game mechanics wise, they're trying to port over a lot of things. Some of them are medieval, some of them are Japanese.
So
yeah.
In the reading, they mentioned that Final Fantasy VII was a sequel to VI. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Is that like correct nomenclature?
You see, and I will disagree with that. Actually, Final Fantasy VII actually has a sequel. For instance,
right?
Was it Crisis Core?
There's a couple, actually.
Yeah, there's one and one, and okay, sure. Well, I mean, first it was the movie, right? The sequel was the movie, and then they did a bunch of things.
Oh, God.
Final Fantasy VII is entry in a series, but you're right. But I think when it comes to this is what we're going to be pitching to a publisher, I'm not sure if Square Enix needs to pitch Final Fantasy itself. I think of another game that has a long series, you know, if anyone can come up with one. Baldur's Gate might be actually a good one because different companies end up
working on different types of
variations. Fallout and Baldur's Gate both come from Interplay, I believe. Originally, so like Fallout.
They went
into
business after Bloodlines. We were talking about this yesterday.
I suspect that was before that. That was Vampire.
Yeah, that was yesterday.
Yeah, but basically, leaving aside what makes a company go out of business, the issue of when you have a series and then you have different companies making different versions. Guitar Hero 3,
Knights of the Old Republic.
So BioWare did the first one, and Obsidian did the second one. Fallout was Bethesda, Obsidian, I believe. Obsidian's really built a whole business model around making part two or something.
Or expansion packs and stuff.
Closely related to that. And in those cases, sometimes, like in the case of BioWare Obsidian connections, they have a good relationship. They're borrowing a lot of technology, and they are getting that advantage of we kind of ironed out the kinks. We're just sort of continuing the story, especially if it's a story-based game. Like Knights of the Old Republic, clearly you've got to fit it within the whole Star Wars story, and they had the interest to basically keep the tale of these characters going, even more so for. Well, for Mass Effect, it was BioWare, but you know that sort of thing. But then you have the other angle where you just want to sort of get the same success, but you want to tell a different story, or in case of Guitar Hero 3, have a completely different set of music. In Final Fantasy VII, you have the certain game mechanics and certain things that carry on from game to game, and definitely you want to carry the fans from game to game, but part of the appeal of the Final Fantasy series is that every single one is going to be a different story. Not dramatically different, but it's going to be a different story. With different characters and different world. But it's pitched very similarly when you go to a game company, and the whole idea is how do we get the fans to buy even more fans to buy version 2. There are the kind of two edges to that sword, though, because what typically happens in a lot of sequel development is that you're trying so hard to please the original fans, and often by adding complexity, by adding things that build on things that players of the first game already know, that you actually start alienating new players. The game becomes just so complex, or just complex enough that people start getting turned off. A couple of weeks ago over here, we played Guitar Freaks on Friday Games for Gambit, and the first version is actually extremely accessible. Once you get from the second version all the way up to, I think, the version 4 that we were playing, it is almost impossible for a new player to jump in because they've got like one beginner-friendly song and everything else is based for fans of the game. So you imagine a Guitar Hero game that's built entirely for people who've already mastered Expert on the previous game. That's kind of what happened with Guitar Freaks. And in many cases, that might be enough to, if a game was particularly successful the first time around and you only get 80% of the fan base to buy the second version, that's still a lot of money. And it's a way lower risk compared to, coming up with new IP from scratch. And a lot of companies, when they're creating IP, they're very much specifically thinking right off the bat, what are the sequel opportunities? Even now, of course, you've got downloadable content, so it's even narrower than that. Is what are downloadable content opportunities? How do we release expansion packs, really, really quickly? And how do we create stories, worlds, technology that's just going to be able to anticipate all that? There's a game up there now on Xbox Live Arcade called Monday Night Combat. And they did some little clever hacks to basically allow them to update the game on a week-to-week basis, whereas typically that kind of certification that's required from Microsoft is really expensive. Every time you want to release a new version, you have to put it through an entire rigorous QA testing schedule again. But they came up with some technology that let them make at least game tuning changes on the fly without having to go through the Microsoft testing. So it's not technically releasing a sequel, but they were very much thinking about how do we keep updating this game. I wouldn't be surprised if Steam started off as that, and Blizzard Battle.net kind of started off as just an easy way for them to get up patches and to keep tuning this game. And eventually someone involved decides, hey, we could sell games this way. And, launch was kind of bumpy, but it's fine now. There is one thing which the book didn't mention, which is the reboot, the sort of franchise reboot. This can sometimes happen when you have a publisher who's got a control of an IP that kind of floundered halfway. Maybe there was a bad execution on an iteration and lost most of its fans, or they just played out the formula to death. And then they want to try to get a new batch of fans. A few people who liked the original one. And I was talking about a Tomb Raider game, where they're just trying to, they've rebooted the Tomb Raider franchise several times at this point. Each time trying to say, okay, you've probably heard from Tomb Raider from the huge amount of advertising that we've done, but you may not actually have liked the previous versions of the games. If I'm going to reboot this franchise by making a different game in that same world, where maybe in Tomb Raider we'll use the characters and we'll use the fiction, but we'll change the gameplay significantly because we're not going after the old fans anymore. We're going after a new batch. It's probably about the same technical challenge as trying to make a sequel for a completely new platform. So because they're basically having to write everything from scratch. But the good news, of course, is that all that previous advertising that you did, a decade ago, still works. Let me think of anyone think of a good example of a good reboot?
Is Mario 64 a reboot?
I think it was seen to a lot of people. A lot of people that it was, because it wasn't clearly a sequel to any of the previous Mario games, and it was kind of Nintendo kind of saying, "Hey,
it's
we
not
still
really a clone of anything."
It's not really a clone. It invented a lot of things for the first time, in fact. I would say that Mario 64, and of course the way how they branded it, they didn't brand it Super Mario World. What, 5 or Super Mario World 4 or something, they call it Mario 64 to sort of distinguish it from its own.
I would almost call it an upgrade more than a reboot, though, because it was mostly just a move from 2D to 3D.
It's a good challenge because to the player, it may seem like it's not that, but for a technical point of view, they had to completely reinvent the way how Mario moves, the way how Mario jumps, frankly. The way how the camera moves, it never used to be a huge problem in the 2D games, but was the primary thing that they managed to figure out how to get working in 3D was the camera. I wouldn't be surprised if their marketing pitched it a little bit like a sequel, but it was also very, very clear of like, this is going to be a whole new generation, you've never played Mario or anything like this, so don't expect your previous Mario experience to carry over necessarily.
I was going to say Metroid as well.
Metroid Prime?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good example of... in fact, Metroid Prime was an instance where they gave the franchise to a completely different developer. You know, previously, it was all old internal Nintendo. And then Nintendo went to a Western developer, Retro Studios, over in Texas, and basically had them make the first-person version of Metroid. But they had a very heavy hand in controlling that. Whereas... I'm not sure we're going to be playing this later. Castlevania: Lords of Shadow, which just came out, was kind of went the other way around. A Western developer, a Spanish developer, decided to make a Castlevania clone. They love Castlevania, and they were going to make a game that was just like Castlevania, but they didn't call it Castlevania because they didn't have the rights for it. And then they showed it off at like an E3 or something, and Konami basically said, "Why don't we just turn this into a Castlevania game?" And they Hideo Kojima on it to sort of make it work.
Awesome. That must have been their dream come true.
That was probably their dream come true. That's what they wanted. And you have the advantage of all the Castlevania fans now saying, okay, this is going to be in canon. If we like Castlevania, we'll probably like this one, which is exactly what they were trying to get across. It's like, imagine the people who made Torchlight being approached from Blizzard and say, why don't we just turn this into Diablo 3?
Yeah. A bunch of people who made Torchlight were from Blizzard, right?
I wouldn't be surprised. In the same sense that a lot of people who made Guild Wars were from the World of Warcraft team. Mm. So that is less issue of sequels and more issue of that's just how the game industry works. People move from project to project and carry knowledge with them.
Like Call of Duty was all met with a lot of people, right?
Yes, Call of Duty. Yes,
I'm not tired of it. We're like, we can do better.
That's an interesting discussion of the, instead of sequels, you have companies making effectively clones, competing against the original franchise. And this particular case that you're drawing, there's people who left EA in 2015, I believe, and then they started Infinity Ward, and they made a game that basically competed with the original.
The first Call of Duty was so ridiculously good, at least. It marked me when I played it for the first time.
But it's very clearly trying to be Medal of Honor, the next version.
Yeah, clearly. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So that's an interesting situation where it's hard to be a spiritual successor when you're competing against the original product. But you can think of them.
BioWare did that with Dragon. I mean, not competing. Spiritual successor was Dragon Age because they don't have the rights to Baldur's Gate anymore.
Dragon Age is more of a D&D clone, I would say. Which is Baldur's Gate.
Empire Earth has reinvented itself with
which one?
With Empire Earth.
Empire Earth.
Oh. With zero success, they're doing under.
I kind of lost track of this.
In the whole game, the first game was like, you can go through 15 ages. You will like model. You can literally play a game against someone and go from prehistoric units to nukes in the same game with everything in between. Mm-hmm. And then they released a sequel, which I think overseas, and then they decided to reinvent themselves and go, we're going to simplify everything. There's just going to be like four ages, kind of like in Age of Empires, and we're not going to have this like massive progression and they try to simplify everything, and it totally bombed.
You see, I think that's a reboot. But I think that's a reboot gone wrong. Our original game is not selling well enough among new players. It's not entirely satisfying our old fans. So we're going to take this franchise that we've advertised really, really well, and we're going to make a completely, effectively a new game, maybe with the same theme, but a new game that's targeted at a new set of players. Sometimes it works, sometimes it bumps. Might and Magic released a game called Clash of Heroes. Might and Magic Clash of Heroes for the Nintendo DS. And who's played any of the original Might and Magic games?
The difference from Heroes of Might and Magic?
Either of them, actually. So who's played Heroes of Might and Magic? Okay, can you describe the game? What's it like?
Do you want to go for it?
Well, it's like a... It's essentially just a turn-based strategy game where you have cities and you have heroes, and these heroes lead armies, and you encounter other smaller armies and try and defeat them and stuff. And you have, like...
And build up your city and start to start with it. You have an economy.
Yeah, and you have an economy, and you build things in your city that can then, like, produce better units for your armies and stuff. You can take over other cities and...
So it's Civilization, I would say.
Yeah, it's like Civilization, but... if you took Civilization and removed everything that wasn't, like, military.
Yeah.
And that also played out in a peculiar sort of distinctive, like, arena...
Yeah, you
turn-based.
Have, like, a battlefield where it's turn-based, and you have your units on one side and the opponent's units on the other side, and you move units together. So, like, if you have, you know, pikemen and bowmen, you have, like, the clump of all bowmen who then move together as a unit.
So, Clash of Heroes is a Nintendo DS game in the Might and Magic series. And what they did was they made a match 3 game. They made a game where it's like Bejeweled. You take 3 bowmen, put them in a row, and then they become a bunch of bowmen who are going to attack. So they get the same idea of let's take... And because of Nintendo DS, there are 2 screens, so the enemy's armies are on one and yours are on the other, and you're just kind of like sending troops up and down. But the gameplay is dramatically different. It's effectively a franchise reboot. They want to sort of get the same idea of leading massive armies against each other. I think they take some of the character, or at least some of the technologies that came from the original Heroes Might and Magic. But that's as far as it got. Everything else they changed because they were going for a completely different audience. The assumption being Nintendo DS players like Match 3 games, like Bejeweled. It's actually really good. I would encourage you if you like Match 3 games. So I was going to put Sarah on the spot for having worked on Thief 2 and Thief Gold and Thief 2 Gold and a number of releases, but maybe you can start telling us a little bit about your original involvement with Thief.
Sure. Do you want me to stand up? Do you can actually hear me? Or?
I can bring the mic closer.
Okay. So Thief, the Dark Project, I came on as the lead tester. Partway through it, I became QA manager, essentially. And then I actually stepped into a design role for about the second half of the project. And I continued to work as a designer and a project manager on Thief 2 and Thief Gold.
What were you designing in Thief 1?
In Thief 1, I was pretty specifically designing gameplay for a level that someone else had already built. Building levels took a lot longer than putting in gameplay, at least from my point of view. I believe the person who built it thought that building levels was a lot faster than putting in gameplay. So it was a good combination. But it was built by an artist who didn't have the scripting experience or the testing patience to go through and make sure that all the experience with the gameplay experience was working. So I was basically handed the level and said, okay, make it fun.
Now, Thief is a first-person stealth game. Basically, you're looking through the eyes of a thief who is not physically all that robust, but he can sneak and he can shoot arrows, usually at your back, and hide. So.
And the AI is, unlike in most games, where AI is tuned sort of, aha, we noticed you, we charge you. The AI is carefully tuned to both tell the player if the AI sort of notices you, if the AI thinks he's looking for you and is looking for you, and if he's actually coming after you, so that a player who makes a noise while sneaking up on them will realize that, oh, he noticed that, I should go be more quiet. So the AI feedback and tuning the AIs was actually really pretty important to play experience of Heart. If you didn't give the player an avenue to approach a guard from behind or to sneak up on them in some way, you were pretty much guaranteeing the player would get killed because the player could not, in fact, take one guard on one-to-one many times. You could probably kill one guard face-to-face, but then you'd be sufficiently wounded that the second fight would finish him off. So you had to be giving the player channels and ways to sneak up and places to hide and things like that if you wanted to have an interesting game and a challenging game.
And that's the gameplay tweaks that you're talking about?
Those are the gameplay tweaks I'm talking about, yeah. Placing AIs, determining their paths, this particular level had a lot of traps in it. So creating the traps and then giving clues to the player in-game so that they could A, either notice the trap was there before getting hit by it and find some other way to trigger it, or notice that it was there, or notice it was there and then discover how to get out of it.
Thief is a
1998 at this point. 1990s. It was released around the same time Doom was.
And it's pretty impressive because in Doom you can't look up, I believe. You can shoot up, but you can't look up.
Yeah, in Thief you can crouch, you can lean around corners, you can in fact shoot your bow while leaning around corners, and you can look up and down and all around,
So that's Thief 1. What happens when Thief 2 gets approved, or,
The first question I had to do was convince people that they wanted to do Thief 2. Because while Thief was a great game, and it has actually sold fairly well over time, its initial sales were not what publishers want to see. Because the initial sales the publisher wants to see is, oh my god, it sold 10 million copies! Awesome! Instead, what we did was we sold a fairly good first initial sell-through, and then it just kind of kept going. So the first thing we had to do was convince them that, yes, Thief 2 would be a good idea. Enough people are continuing to buy Thief 1 that those same people will all run out and buy Thief 2 on the very first day. And the way we did that was, first of all, taking a look at forums and saying, hey, look, people are pretty excited about this. They're enjoying it. It's got good lasting power. Our fans are going to stick around to play with it a second time. And that was sort of a marketing and analysis that kind of went into the publisher. And the other part was saying, okay, what are the improvements we're going to make to this game? How are we going to change this game to make it better than Thief 1 while still taking advantage of everything we did? So we created basically a big design doc with, here are the areas that we thought we could have done better than Thief 1. Here's what we're going to improve. And here are the changes we're going to make. So we're not going to make Thief 1 again. We're going to take what Thief 1 was, add some improvements to it, make a deeper story, and hopefully give a more variety of gameplay was what we actually ended up aiming for in our initial docs. We wanted to give Garrett additional abilities, vary the gameplay. The gameplay in Thief 1 was all sneak. We tried to have some additional types of missions in Thief 2. It's been long enough that there was a little more face-to-face fighting. There was a little more subterfuge. Instead of just sneaking around, we also had, okay, so now you need to disguise yourself as someone and sneak in and sneak out again because you need to pass for them while getting a goal done and things like that. So we tried to find what are additional stealth and subterfuge issues in gameplay we can add in.
How many of those features in Thief 2 were inherited from dropped features of Thief 1?
A lot of them inherited from dropped ideas from Thief 1, but when they first started designing Thief, and I was not on the initial Thief design team, so now I'm making up what they were talking about. It wasn't clear that it was going to be, it was sort of like, it's going to be a stealthy game, but we hadn't actually defined what stealthy gameplay was yet. So it was Thief 1 that kind of told us this is what stealth gameplay is that works, and once we found the one or two things that worked, we kind of went with that and hung with that. It was in Thief 2, we got to play around with what are some other ideas of stealthy gameplay, what are some other ways to trick people into football.
If people have played Metal Gear Solid or any of the games in the Metal Gear Solid series, it always a lot of Thief, especially the really, really noisy NPCs. The one said, I heard something, I wonder what's over there. That's all from Thief.
Deus Ex also.
But Deus Ex also always a lot of Thief.
Yeah, well that's what I'm saying, is that Deus Ex also actually took a lot of Thief's lessons and went on with them from there.
Again, a lot of people working on Thief are doing Deus Ex.
Deus Ex 2, or Deus Ex 2, but yeah. Looking Glass folded and went out of business, and a lot of people moved to Austin to then work on Thief 3 and Deus Ex 2 and those projects there. So.
I have a question about the gold version.
The gold version. The gold versions of the games are really a way to try to convince, from the marketing point of view, is a way to convince players to buy the same material again. So I'm being a little cynical here, and I admit that. But we added we added several new missions. So it was in Spanish play, and then we went back and problems that we knew were in the missions, we fixed them. And we actually added some richer gameplay to several of the missions that, oh god, we have to get this out the door, this would be so cool if we could set this up, but we don't have time to, and out it goes. And so we went back and we touched up over half of the missions. We added some additional gameplay, we added extra goals, we took areas where we thought the gameplay was particularly weak because we'd gotten rushed on finishing it, and we made the levels a bit longer and a little more interesting in our opinion. And then we also added 3 new levels in. It was kind of a chance, it was a do-over. We had very limited programming resources, so we didn't really need to add in much in the way of new features, but we were able to go back and tune it and make significant changes to the levels, to the way that the guards worked, to the scripting behind the levels. If anyone's working on a 3D mod, you know, there's usually a fair bit that a designer can do behind the walls of telling the AIs what to do and how to think and how the gameplay flows. And Thief especially had an extremely rich editor that more powerful, I think, than any other editor I've ever worked with, even though it is now 15 or 20 years old. 15 years old, I think. It's still the most powerful editor for a designer that I've ever seen.
So, did you feel that in, like, how much, you mentioned you looked at forums and you looked at fans, mm-hmm. right? And how much of that, of what went into debating the sequels, actually came from fan input? Or was it just like verifying what you already wanted to do?
Part of it was to verify what we wanted to do. Part of it was to verify there was enough interest that people would want to do it. Part of it was to see what did people like most? Which of the missions did people like most? And what are there any good ideas out there for how to play a game that we think, yes, you know, they're right, we never thought of that. I think that one of the things people talked about a lot was actually disguise missions. And I think we had 2 disguise missions in Thief 2 where you kind of disguise yourself as no one look at me, I'm just another guard walking around, don't worry about me. And that was something that we said, oh yeah, that would be really cool. And that's something we had no time to implement for Thief, but if we're choosing which features, new features to implement for Thief 2, that was actually not an amazingly difficult one. Because you just, you know, figure out a way to put a tag on the player that says, oh, guards don't get upset when you see you.
Did you have situations where players came out with exploits that you tried to address in the gold version?
There were not, no. Actually, there were a couple of places where people found bugs that were level enders that got people stuck that we went in and fixed. There were not a whole lot of exploits that I recall us trying to go in and fix.
So if somebody like deliberately found something that put them on the roof of the castle or something like that, then you didn't bother trying to
If it allowed the player to get the place where it broke the game, we did try to fix it, because we tried to fix anything that was a game breaker, where you could get up on the wall and then leap off into the void. But sometimes what we do is, rather than stop you from getting up on the castle and proving how cool you were, we'd let you get up on the castle, but we'd put in an invisible barrier so you couldn't hurl yourself into the darkness and then crash the game. So, right there. If players enjoy finding those things, so taking them out doesn't enhance the gameplay. And the point of the gold project was to try to make something where the gameplay was sufficiently enhanced that it was worthwhile to go out and buy again.
So now we're in an environment where patches are pretty much just down the hill, right?
You yeah.
know, we don't necessarily have that situation in the early 90s. Is there still a rule of space called gold versions, re-releases?
I think now, again, that would be an expansion pack. I don't think that you would do a gold version. You do an expansion pack, and with an expansion pack patch, you could fix old problems, and you might introduce new versions of levels. But I don't think you go through the hassle of doing a gold. I think you just do an expansion pack.
Thanks. Questions for Sarah?
So pretty much all your data points, like, just came from forums.
Oh no, that was just one of the places where we looked. We also looked at sales and continued sales and things like that. Like I said, that was actually more of a marketing sales to sort of do, here's why we think players will like it, here's some experiences we got. here's the hard data on our sales, how our sales are continuing, and the fact that Thief is having, while it did not come out and sell 100,000 copies the first month, it's continuing to sell 20 or 30,000 copies a month, which means that word of mouth is pretty strong, and people are continuing to go out and buy it and go out and play it. And here's the forum where a whole bunch of people are using the editor we released, and the activity in that forum is going up over time, not down over time, which indicates you've got more people coming into it. People are coming in, they're staying at it and using it, and you've got more people continuing to come in, the community's growing, which means that there's interest there, and there's people who are paying attention to the project and are going to continue to pay attention to the product.
Yeah, but also for gameplay, for finding dead ends, for finding, so you said you need to fix some dead ends in the game, so you found out about those.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. Well, the difference between a, let me think. At our height, we had a 12-person QA department, and 50,000 users is pretty big. We did our best on testing it, and we had like another 10 or 15 helpers through our publisher, but I mean, we had, comparatively speaking, a ridiculously small QA department for the game.
But then you have a situation where someone does something on the forum, and then you can verify it with your QA team.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And you can actually figure out whether what they were seeing was exactly the problem they were describing.
And it being a solely single-player game, I know a lot of games do, do large beta tests where they ask, 500 or 200 or 1,000 people to play the game. We did not do any external testing like that at all. Yeah.
It was also back in the 90s. That would have
been also, yeah, it was not the sort of thing that was really done in the 90s as well. So. It's very much a developmental shift.
Did you ever explicitly ask on the forums, like, if there were another sequel, would you buy it? Or did it just...
I don't know. Okay. I did not do that. I was not on the forums. I helped with some of the forum data and read forums, but I didn't really post on the forums a lot.
Do you think that would be a viable tactic, or would you just say people would probably just say yes?
I think that your data would be very good.
Okay.
I mean, the most you're probably going to get is 1,000 people who read the forum say yes, and that's 1,000 people, and that's not enough sales to justify doing anything.
Gotcha.
So it's more interesting. I think it's more useful to look at trends. Like if you've got like a survey out, maybe, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I've seen companies bring in focus groups of their people who played the first game to come in, and they're bouncing off either prototypes or features that they're planning for the second version to see how they would respond to them. I would say that the information you get back from that is also not very good.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be something that is done to gain traction in internal studio politics. And I was like, well, we did this exercise where we brought these people in, and they said these features are okay, so we can take the risk of actually developing it, as opposed to, driving the entire process.
Games don't respond really well to focus test based development.
Well, focus group.
Yeah. Focus group based group development. Getting feedback on your games is great. Finding out how many people are likely to like your game is a lot harder.
Especially if they can't actually see it when you ask them that question, then they have no idea what they're commenting on. They'll make something up that they think you want to hear. It's like, yes, of course we'll buy a copy of the game. We love the first one, sure, but you've never actually seen the second version of the game. Neither have you, so you don't actually know that case. For those of you who missed Iran Ngozi's talk last week, he was talking about how in Amplitude, which was a sequel, what's it, Amplitude or
Frequency? Frequency is the first one, Amplitude is the second.
Oh, yeah. I think it wasn't the very first one, so that was Frequency. He was talking about how the folks from Sony were helping them run their focus groups. And they did two tests. And one of the tests was, after they played the game, they did a survey of how many people were planning on buying this when it came out. And they had like some ridiculously high score, like 80% or something like that. Like the highest Sony guy I've ever seen. But they also did a survey of how many people were planning on buying the game just by looking in the box before they played the game. And that was a ridiculously low number. And the Sony people called it. It's like, this is not going to sell. Because, sure, the people who played your game are going to enjoy your game, but no one's going to play your game in the first place. Because people can't figure out what your game's about. And you try to address those problems with the sequel. That's one thing with Brenda talks about. Your chance to do a do-over, a chance for you to go back and fix the problems that you found in the first one. Especially when you find those problems really close to ship date. There's nothing that you can do about for the first time around.
but if you're lucky, you get a second chance to do it.
Yeah. I also noticed that frequency was not called in, it wasn't
frequency 2, they called it amplitude, so it was actually kind of a reboot as well. It was like they kind of just wanted people, okay, let's pretend frequency didn't happen, and let's do that. But we'll make sure that the frequency people who loved the game know that.
Have a time. Yeah. It's much easier to tell the small base who liked you, oh yeah, and buy this game, than it is to say, tell a large group of people who weren't interested in the first time, no, you didn't like it the first time, but trust us, you'll like it this time.
I've seen a couple of companies do effectively gold versions every time they move to a new platform. Like the latest platform which they release it from tends to become the definitive version, that if you're a big fan of the franchise and you're willing to buy this game multiple times, you want to get that because of the few extra features that they put in. Maybe it's different endings, maybe it's upgraded cutscenes, if it's a role-playing game, I see that a lot. Maybe they read the cutscene from scratch, or read the audio from scratch. So it's the same assets, but clearer and it's higher resolution. And of course, you have games that started off their lives as online flash games and stuff like that, and then you get moved onto other platforms like DS or PSP. And those games tend to have not only completely reworked controls, because the controls are different, but also a lot more features, because you have to now justify to people who may have loved the game but didn't pay any money for the first version to actually put down money for it now. So N is a good example of that. It's one that is a game that came out by Xbox Live Arcade and the DS and PSP, but started its life as a free flash game. And lots of people loved it, but lots of people didn't have to pay any money for the first version. So how much they love it is kind of a weird factor. So, that's a long bit of a shot. Okay. I guess we should start with the games. Any more questions?